was hoping that after Death Sentence and Weasel Words that you'd run out of material.
No, it didn't happen. I have this website, which a friend of mine runs, Helen Smith, and it just fills up all the time. And this book is a sort of emptying of the website, a selection of the best and worst. Well, that is to say, the best are the worst and the worst are the best. And it gets bigger all the time. I mean, there's no end to this. It's a virus, and it just spreads and spreads and attaches itself to new hosts every year, and they become carriers, and on it goes.
How do you kill this virus?
I think it may be too late. I think it's, you know, think of a cane toad or a blackberry. They're very hard to eradicate. I don't think there is a way. I think it's now taken hold in places that undreamt of. You know, when it gets into community organisations, local government, primary classrooms, universities, country fire authorities, everywhere. And as Ellen Ramsey was saying so eloquently on the television the other night, politics especially, where now you really get messaged. You're not addressed or spoken to, or, you know, when they talk about having a conversation with the public, you've got to be kidding. You just get bland, meaningless phrases, which every genius in a political office insists of and has become expert at delivering, and that's what they go out and tell you. Mm. I find it nauseating. I really just can't listen. I get too angry. I run off the road. That's why I listen to the races.
Can you listen to Question Time these days?
No, I don't bother. I don't bother. There's nothing. Question Time has become. People used to dislike it in the days of Keating and before because it was a roughhouse. You know, lots of things were said which people didn't think was gentlemanlike or ladylike. But it was at least there was I used to listen to it as a kid, you know, as a young person, because I loved the sound of the language in there. You know, you got the vernacular full tilt, plus you got from, you know, the members for Kuyong and places like that, that old way of rounded vowel, you know, upper class Australian. It was a wonderful place to study Australia, even on the radio, especially on the radio, because you weren't distracted by images as you are now. And in a way, I think the televising of Parliament has turned everybody into sort of bad performers. They're all hams, and you get displays behind, and you know, they seat women behind the leader of the opposition and the prime minister to show that there are women in the Parliament, and it's a very depressing spectacle, and worse to listen to.
Can I run some phrases by you? Phrases that have been used recently in federal politics. Irregular maritime arrivals.
Yeah, well, I think I know what they are. That would be those Sri Lankans those 64 Sri Lankans who've frightened the wits out of the entire nation. Driven them to decide they're going to vote Liberal. We've always hated irregular maritime arrivals. They really can frighten us off our farms.
The stimulus spending has been rephased.
Has it? I feel that's unlikely to affect me. I didn't get the $800. And yet people who got $3 million, who earned $3 million last year, did get $800, I hear.
Detailed programmatic specificity. I can't even say it.
No, not without a mouth guard on. Detailed program, no. That's one that's just, that is completely lost. There's not even any meaning there for the person who wrote it.
I'm going to read you a quote. I think there's a large degree of consensus that we need to have an alternative framework to the non-existing framework which existed in the past. There are still some disagreements about the actual nature of the framework for the future.
Yeah, well, there would be, I imagine, if that's where you started. Was that Mark Vail? It sounded reminiscent of the former Deputy Prime Minister.
I noticed that Mark Vail gets a regular Guernsey in your book.
No, he was an absolute specialist at this. And to think that he, you know, he represents a rural constituency, where people on farms grew up speaking the language of Henry Lawson, and they made it up as they went along. It was wonderful. The vernacular lived there. And now they talk business talk. It's in fact, The worst thing about this language is that everyone, as each new group takes it up, they take it up with added zeal, as all new converts do, and with even less understanding of what it means. I just committed one of those sort of sporting interview sins, and yeah.
Most of these quotes have come from Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister. When it comes to weasel words, some of his critics say he would win a gold medal if there was an award for it. What do you think of his language and the way he speaks to Australia?
I'm less worried about Australians who are thoroughly infected already. I'm more worried that he's speaking Mandarin to the Chinese, because we don't know what he's telling them. But if he's talking like this to them, China, it's going to go through China like wildfire. They'll all be doing this business speak and none of them will understand each other anymore. It may be a way of bringing them down. I think it's fair to say, Prime Minister, that as the Prime Minister, it's not enough to say good to be with you. I mean, I think he really ought to see it as his one of his responsibilities to use the language as it's meant to be used. I mean, he does understand language very well. He knows when and how to use it well, which makes it all the less forgivable that he uses it so tiresomely so often.
What has caused this? It's an infestation. It's like Patterson's curse. Some people think it looks good, but it's a noxious weed.
Yes, it's worse than Patterson's curse, because in bad seasons, as we know, Patterson's curse becomes Salvation Jane, but and the sheep will eat it. But this, you can't eat this. It's inedible. How did it happen? It started off, you know, in that weird hybrid of management theory in the 1980s, which had come out of all sorts of, you know, resplendent intellectual sources like EST, training dynamics, and Maslow's hierarchy of needs, advertising in general. That's really where it came from, and it became a sort of pseudoscience for business with a language attached to bind it all together and make people behave, or to make them feel like they belong, which is the same thing. And it's a sort of power relationship in an organisation, and so long as it stayed in private sector corporations, it probably didn't do a great deal of harm. But it got out of the laboratory, and we privatised half the public sector anyway, so they all took it on. And then the public sector, feeling that they mustn't look in any way inferior to the private, took it on with knobs on. And so by the early 90s, the private sector were worse than the public sector was worse than the private in this regard. Politicians liked it because it helps to fill those terrible gaps in their knowledge or their ability to answer questions. And it's a very hard thing to do. But no one's actually shown that they wouldn't be just as well off, if not a good deal better, by simply answering the question and saying they don't know. Can't answer it now, ask me next week or something. And no one's really shown convincingly that a politician who speaks to us in ordinary English will somehow do worse than one who talks this rubbish. Anyway, then it, because it got into the public sector, it went down into schoolrooms and hospitals and old people's homes, where suddenly they became customers, old folks, and clients, and were asked questions they couldn't possibly understand, and it just became balmier and balmier, so that you end up with adverse patient outcomes. That word outcome is a classic. I mean, it's just everywhere. You can have an outcome can be really anything, but what it tends to be in any organisation is something which in fact is related to the person doing the administering rather than the person to whom it's meant to be administered. And when you combine it with impact, which can be anything from being struck by a meteorite and vaporised to being bitten by a mosquito or suffering from athlete's foot or something, they're all impacts. So everything, all the other words in between get lost. You don't need any other word like scratch or itch or burn or hot or anything. And then you see the same thing in something like the Country Fire Authority, which finds itself unable to express in concrete terms the danger that's approaching with a fire. They can't describe a fire. In fact, they say to the Royal Commission that they couldn't describe it because it was unprecedented, as if this was the first fire there had ever been. They could have gone to the Old Testament for a description of a fire, or Dante or something. But they really didn't need to go that far. They just need to go, say, the fire in Canberra a few years ago. And that would have given people some idea that they may not be able to fight this thing with a hose. But instead they issued fire event warnings and weather event warnings and wind event warnings and heat events and talked about combined weather events and impacts, fires impacting and fire impacts. And no one ever said this thing might be something you can't possibly fight. And this is what it's going to be like, at the very least. And when it gets to that point, you begin to think, well, not only is it stupid and derisory, it's sort of sinister. And it's more sinister, I think, even than the example of the fires. It's more sinister in that it's sort of... It enables government departments and other organisations to pretend to themselves and the public at large that something is being done when it's not, or the opposite of what is claimed is actually being done. So you can have a state or territory education department claiming that children are being educated in, for instance, remote Aboriginal communities, and that the children are achieving outcomes which reach the national benchmarks. And when you go to the place and sit down with the children and ask them questions after 5 years of this education system in a school that was built by the department, and realise that they are totally illiterate and innumerate, that they have not learned anything because the teacher's never there, or there once in a blue moon. And you think, the outcomes are not for these kids at all, they're actually for the department. And then it becomes less like the operation of a well-functioning democracy, and more like a sort of weirdly Stalinist thing. You know, that where bureaucrats decide, as Stalin said he would, what words mean and what they don't mean. So what you end up with is a sort of Orwellian system planted not on an authoritarian society, as Orwell always imagined, but rather an Orwellian system planted on a capitalist democracy. And I don't know how that works. We've done it voluntarily. Educational institutions, seeing the approach of managerialism, rolled over, put their legs in the air and said, do it to me, do it to me. They did. You might have said, hell, no, we've already been mugged by vocationalism. Let's stand up to this and say, well, we'll protect the language, whatever happens. We're not going to give in to all this. We're universities. We're education departments. Very opposite happened.
Do you lament the fact that politicians aren't talking to Australia? They're not communicating. They're not having a conversation.
No, they just send us messages. And they call it spin, you know, which would... Look, if it was spin, it'd be fantastic. I wouldn't mind... Spin sort of suggests something mesmerising. This isn't spin, it's anaesthetic. It's like a big cloud of gas that comes over and makes, you know, cutting your toenails look interesting. Whatever you're doing at the time, you're able to just get on with it because the words aren't going to be doing anything for you. I suspect that not only does it lower the quality of public debate, but it must, in some way, you would think it would discourage people who believe in the language, in whether you're using plain English or vernacular English or any kind of English. You wouldn't be encouraged to go into politics in this way. In general, it sort of makes politics look even less attractive than it is for other reasons. Can't be good, I don't think. But now when you look at the front benches of both sides, and I'm sure they're nice people. I'm fairly sure. But it wouldn't... It's hard to think of anyone there of great character who you would say, well, he's a character. I don't mean that they're, you know, they've got bad morals or their values aren't aligned with their strategic goals going forward or anything like that. And you know, I wouldn't say that for a moment, or that they don't have their mission statements tucked firmly in their pockets. But I do mean people who are interesting and who might say something, you know, that you think, oh, listen to him because he might say something funny, or he might have an idea, or he might have some construction. I don't care whether it's grammatical or not, but he just might say something that catches my attention. And he might make me think, or she might, well, what a fascinating bloke. I wouldn't mind meeting him. Instead, you think, oh, well, there goes another one. You know, I'll get back to the ironing. I'll do, you know, whatever. Whatever.
Is that it? We're never going to see the engaging and entertaining politician again?
I don't know where they're going to come from. Who would do it? You know the sort of person who would do it. People who want to, you know, who are just habitually bland.
And have it on their mission statement.
And all the mission statements are the same anyway. They just download them off the net. And they've been writing them, you know, as time goes by, though, or I should say going forwards. We know they will have been written their first mission statement when they were in primary school, so they'll be expert at it. They'll know when to realign their values and their goals and when not to, and how to get their synergies, that sort of thing.
Don Watson, thank you for your time.
Thanks.